The second case for oral argument this morning is Veronica Duffy versus the Circuit Court for the 7th Judicial Circuit. This is an original proceeding filed in this court. Ms. Duffy appears on her own behalf and for the respondents, Circuit Court of the 7th Judicial Circuit is Mr. Jeffrey P. Hallam, an Assistant Attorney General. Ms. Duffy may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Veronica Duffy, and I am the petitioner in an original petition for a writ of cert that was filed before this court. The respondent is the Circuit Court for the 7th Judicial Circuit. I want to say at the beginning that I mean no offense by bringing this action. I mean no offense to the judicial office. I have the utmost respect for judges and for the job they do. I think it's a difficult and thankless job. And in particular, I have the utmost respect for Judge Kern, who is the underlying circuit court judge who cut my bill in this case. I think Judge Kern is a terrific judge. She exercises wonderful judgment. She's very professional, very thorough. It's just that in this particular case, I respectfully disagree with what was done with my bill.
I'm not clear on what you're exactly seeking. Are you seeking an order from this court directing the bill to be paid in full or some lesser relief?
I am asking the court to enter an order requiring that my bill be paid in full. However, I also believe practically the entirety of the circuit court file, including all the transcripts, is before this court. And I think you have subject matter jurisdiction and jurisdiction over the parties. And because of all of the information that has been provided to this court, and this is an original action, I think you also have the ability to enter an order requiring payment in a lesser amount than the amount I'm requesting. But I am requesting payment in full of my bill.
So you don't see a need for a remand? You think that we can...
I don't, Your Honor. And here's the reason why. The circuit court in this case has already had two bites at the apple to try to explain these cuts. Judge Kern issued a letter on December 11th of 2002 in which she attempted to explain the cuts, actually three bites. In January, then, she provided me with highlighted copies of the bills in the little A&N action and the little criminal action, the highlighted entries showing where cuts were made. And then on April 7th of 2003, the circuit court as a whole issued a written decision attempting to explain the cuts. Despite those three opportunities to explain these cuts, there remain huge amounts of the cuts for which no explanation at all is offered. And many of the other cuts represent a gross abuse of discretion, which I will get to in a moment. The starting point for payment of attorney's fees, where courts appoint attorneys to represent criminal indigents, is SDCL 23A-40-A, which provides that an attorney shall be paid a reasonable and just compensation for his services within guidelines established by the presiding judge of the circuit court. Our presiding judge of our court issued Standing Order 001 pursuant to 23A-40-8. Interestingly, the very first paragraph of Standing Order 001 states that the fact that an attorney is appointed to represent a criminal indigent for a reduced fee in no way diminishes the attorney's responsibility to the client. In other words, the fact that you are representing this client for a reduced fee does not diminish your ethical responsibility to represent that client zealously and to the best of your ability. Furthermore, Standing Order 00-1 states that if the full amount of attorney's fee voucher is not paid by the circuit court, quote, must explain the reasons, close quote, for the cut. If the attorney is unsatisfied, he may then request a hearing by all the judges in the circuit, which is what I did in this case. In Tappy versus Circuit Court, a decision by this court, the court interpreted 23A-40-8. And although this court noted that a circuit court has wide latitude and discretion in determining what constitutes a reasonable attorney's fee, that discretion is informed by two separate inquiries. One, is the hourly rate reasonable? And two, Were the services that were provided reasonably necessary and was a reasonable amount of time spent on those services? I'm not challenging the hourly rate in this case. A subsequent standing order established the hourly rate as $69 an hour, and I accept that as a reasonable reasonable hourly rate. So the only issue that's presented to this court is whether or not the services I rendered in behalf of my four clients, two clients, four cases, was reasonably necessary and whether I spent a reasonable amount of time on those. In Tappy, this court stated that a trial court is, quote, under an obligation to provide explanations or rationale for the disallowance of attorney's fees. Tappy cited to two other cases that I think are informative. People versus Illinois, cited in the text of the Tappy decision, says that the budget cannot be balanced on the backs of court-appointed counsel. Under Gideon versus Wainwright, it is a societal burden to provide adequate defense counsel for criminal indigents.
Now, Tappy says, if I understand you right, that they're to give you a rationale. That's kind of a general statement. Is it good enough for the judge to say, well, based on my 25 years on the bench, this is what I think the case is worth?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, and I think that leads to arbitrary results. Tappy says that in determining what is reasonable, a court must examine whether the hourly rate is reasonable and whether a reasonable amount of time was spent on services that are reasonably necessary. I think that the conclusion that you draw from that language in Tappy is that a circuit court has great discretion in determining what services are reasonably necessary and whether a reasonable amount of time was spent on them, but a court is not free to simply say, I think this is unreasonable, or we're under budget constraints this year and we just can't afford to pay this much.
That brings up another issue. Are budget constraints even relevant in your view?
No, I don't believe they should be. Under Gideon versus Wainwright, the state has an obligation to provide indigent defense, criminal defendants with counsel. And that's a policy decision that the legislature has to encounter to decide how they're going to fund that mandate. And for example, in Pennington County, we have a three-tier system of handling criminal indigent defendants. The first tier is the Pennington County Public Defender's Office. Then if they have a conflict, the defendant is passed on to Dakota Plains Legal Services. And if Dakota Plains has a conflict, then the case is passed on to a private attorney as a criminal appointment. Another.
Backing up just a minute. Are you suggesting that there's no room in the Tappy factors for a global look at a case, standing back and saying, you know, this is a DUI, it was a plea, it's simply not worth $10,000. I mean, are you suggesting that the Tappy doesn't even permit that kind of a global look at a case?
I don't think it does, and here's why. If the starting point of the analysis is this is a DUI and I think this is just too much, then there ought to be entries in the bill that show that the attorney engaged in activities that were not reasonably necessary for the defense of a DUI. Tappy does not talk about taking a global look. And this court in the unified judicial system several years ago abandoned flat rate fees. And I think that the rationale that you're speaking of, Justice Center, gives rise to a flat fee mentality. Well, no matter what the issues are, we think that $5,000 is adequate for a murder case that pleads and doesn't go to trial. Another case that was cited in Tappy it elucidates on that particular issue that you're talking about. It's the Iowa case of Hulse versus Wivfat. And Tappy cited that decision for the proposition that in evaluating a fee cut, the court must consider, first of all, the high degree of diligence and preparation that's necessary to defend in a criminal case. And in addition, the court must consider the individual facts and circumstances that are peculiar to that case. And Hulse goes on to say that those issues are judged from the perspective of the reasonable attorney at the time that the services were rendered. Now, I know that the state, on behalf of the circuit court, has argued in their brief that those factors should be evaluated with the benefit of hindsight. And I don't believe that that's appropriate. I can't think of any other area of the law where we hold somebody accountable or we punish somebody because what they did at the time was reasonable from an objective standpoint. And yet, with the benefit of 18 months hindsight or 6 months hindsight, it then becomes unreasonable or marginally necessary.
Were there expert fees involved in any of these cases?
Yes, there were in the little criminal case.
Was there concern about those?
No, they were not. I shouldn't say no. Judge Kern appointed a psychiatrist so that I could do both a competence and a sanity evaluation on my client in the little criminal matter. And then she also appointed a child interview expert to assist me in that case because it involved allegations of child abuse. The children were interviewed forensically, and I, from reading cases, I gathered that there were some protocols that applied to how you're supposed to conduct child interviews, but I didn't know what those protocols were, so I asked to consult. Judge Kern appointed both of those experts to assist me. As you know from the record, Ms. Little was committed to the Human Services Facility in Yankton 3 times before I was done representing her. After the second time that she was committed, Judge Kern instituted an order that required me to get pre-approval for a consultation with my psychiatrist before any further consultations occurred. But
so your total amount did not include the expert fees, or did it?
Did not. Those expert fees were billed separately and submitted to the court under separate cover.
Let me take you back to my question once more. If we do need to look at the specifics, and we need to look at every line item, for instance, the line items in your billings, how is the trial judge going to be able to make an informed decision with, you know, sketchy information that you put in your billing? Sometimes it's very detailed and sometimes it's not. And there's going to be occasions where including some explanation in there is going to breach some confidential relationships and disclose information that should not be disclosed. I mean, I think you're suggesting that we're going to end up having mini trials on every single line item in your bill.
That may be a case that's presented in the future, Justice Zinter, but it's not a case that's presented on the facts here. In the facts of this case, the cuts in the Wilson bills and the cuts in the Little bills, none of the explanations that I've been provided add up to the full amount of the cuts. For example, the most egregious example is the Little A&N bill. I submitted my bill and a cut of $1,696.14 was made. That's exactly 50% to the penny of the amount of that bill that was submitted. Judge Kern went through and highlighted various entries as unnecessary. Those highlighted entries, which are my only explanation for why my bill is being cut in that A&N case, amount to $696.90. There's a full $1,000 that is not explained at all, either in the respondent's April 7th written decision, or in the highlighted entries, or in Judge Kern's December 11th decision.
Well, what's wrong with getting it 15%? Maybe that's what she thinks the case is worth.
I don't think that that's allowable under TAPI. Under TAPI, under the South Dakota statute, and under our standing order, the obligation of a circuit judge to explain cuts that are made in an attorney's voucher is mandatory. The word must and shall and obligation are used.
So the court is required to explain each line item that it cuts. That has to go through line by line and explain whether that is reasonable or unreasonable.
I think at the very least, I'm not arguing that the highlighted versions are in and of themselves inadequate explanation. I can certainly tell when Judge Kern has highlighted an entry and slashed the time entry off to the side, that means that entire time entry is stricken. What I'm saying is that in these cases, if you add up even those highlighted entries, they don't add up to the full amount of the cuts.
Here's a situation I had when I was a circuit judge, and I had these bills presented to me for over a period of 10 years. You could appoint several lawyers on one case, say an A&N case, where you'd have a lawyer for the mother, a lawyer for the father, and a lawyer for the children. And you get the impression that the lawyers were doing essentially the same amount of work, had the same court appearances, they had the same type of preparation. And yet, I would see sometimes grossly divergent bills where one lawyer would bring a bill in for $2,500, another lawyer would bring in a bill for two or three times that amount. And so I was dealing with a situation where you have to say, well, every line item looks reasonable in the high bill, and every line item looks reasonable in the low bill. How does a judge balance that, other than looking at the whole case and saying, look, the bill for $7,500 is, in my experience, is simply too high. It's simply too much time spent on a case that doesn't deserve that amount of time. How else do you do it?
I go back to my response to Justice Zinter. I think that a global approach that says this is just too much for our budget, or this is just too much for this type of case, leads to arbitrary results. I had 8 criminal appointments during the 18 months that were surveyed by the Pennington County Auditor and reported in her affidavit that was submitted. Of those 8 appointments, I was paid $17,000. Of the $17,000, $15,000 were paid on these 4 appointments that are the subject of this fee appeal. That means I have 4 other appointments that I handled for less than $700 per appointment, $2,500. The problem with these fee cuts, if they're not explained, and the reason why I pursued this appeal of this fee cut, is because when an attorney's fees are cut in an indigent criminal case, I think it gives rise to an inference that the attorney is either overbilling or incompetent. And I don't believe I'm either. The court will have to judge for itself.
You took it personally. You thought that Judge Kern's decision on your cases was a personal, even though she says not in her written statement, you took it as a criticism of your competence.
I won't deny that there is a certain personal element. But the main reason why I pursued this is because I asked for an explanation, and in large part, I either A, didn't get one for large parts of the cuts, no explanation at all. With regard to the Wilson cuts, I didn't get any explanation for what the line items were until this petition was filed. And I had repeatedly notified the court that I didn't have any explanation for those Wilson fee cuts, and I was not given an explanation. My explanation came after the hearing and after this petition for cert had been filed. But in addition, as to the items that I was notified were being cut, I believe that many of them are arbitrary. For example, in the Wilson number 1 case, which is the case I argued before this court last month in Yankton, there were 3 items that were completely stricken. 1, an entry for reading the indictment. 2, an entry for speaking with my co-defendant's counsel to find out what he knew and what legal issues he was raising in his case. And 3, an entry for reading a Supreme Court case on a Fourth Amendment issue that was pertinent to the suppression issue I was raising.
But doesn't this argument lend credence to the view that a case is worth so many dollars in totality, or you're simply going to get bogged down and, well, I was entitled to make this phone call. No, you weren't. Well, I was entitled to go talk to my client about this. No, that was a waste of time. I mean, we're going to be here forever sogging through line after line after line trying to decide, was this necessary or not? What do we do on a major trial? I mean, you're going to have another trial after the trial, and that's on fees.
Well, Your Honor, that's certainly one policy issue, and I don't deny that that's an administrative issue that will have to be tackled by the courts, but that's no less than what TAPI demands and what our standing order demands. Furthermore, there's a competing public policy interest, and that is when an attorney accepts an appointment, number 1, the ethical rules say you shouldn't turn down an appointment unless you have a conflict of interest. It's in the nature of a public duty, a public service that you owe to the court. 2, you're being paid at a greatly reduced fee. This fee that I was being paid is about half of what my normal hourly rate is. And the implicit trade-off for that agreement on behalf of the attorney, who is under the same duty to represent their client zealously and to their best of their ability as they are in a case in which you're being paid in full, is that even though you're being paid a reduced fee, you will be paid in full.
And you are required, I understand it too, to submit your bill in a line item form. You're required to account for every hour that you're charging or quarter hour.
Yes, Your Honor.
Have you represented defendants in federal court
I have, Your Honor. I've had...
Do they still have the system where you just simply have one sheet and you just list the hours in different categories and that's...
We have to submit two documents. There's a voucher form that we fill out that has totals for everything. Then you have to submit a separate itemized statement, just like you do in state court, of your hours. Of the seven appointments that I've had in federal court, I've never, ever had my bill questioned. And I've handled, as I pointed out in my brief, similar cases in federal court to this methamphetamine possession case that I handled in state court.
Help me with one fact issue. I thought I recalled seeing in the line items that there were one or more entries where there was actually a cut for an appearance in court.
Yes, and I was just going to get to that, Justice Center. In the criminal case involving Catherine Little, the state had filed a notice of intent to use child hearsay statements. And as you know, under the tender years exception, that requires a pretrial hearing where the court determines the availability of the children and the reliability of the hearsay statements. That hearing was made necessary entirely by the state's motion and notice. All of the witnesses who were called to testify at that hearing were subpoenaed by the state. I did not notice up the hearing. I did not require any witnesses to testify. The hearing took 2 hours and 40 minutes. And I submitted a time entry that for 4 hours that included attending the hearing, preparing for the hearing, and meeting briefly with my client after the hearing to explain to her what had happened and what to expect next. Judge Kern cut my time entry for that particular entry to 2 hours. That didn't even cover the full time of the hearing, which was 2 hours and 40 minutes. Under Judy versus White, which is the Supreme Court of West Virginia case I cited to the court in my brief, that constitutes a gross abuse of discretion and provides evidence. Here's the bottom line, I think, in this case. These cuts in my bills were not made because the court believed that my services were not reasonably necessary or because they thought that I spent too long. These cuts were made for budgetary reasons, and that's inappropriate.
Did the court say that?
The evidence that I have for that is as follows. Judge Kern told me that orally when she first notified me that she was going to cut my bill. Judge Kern's December 11th letter in written form makes reference to the budget. The respondent's April 7th decision makes reference to the circuit court's duty to watch after the public fisc. But most telling of all is the cuts themselves. If the process had been first to go through and flag entries that the court thought were unnecessary or unnecessarily long, then all you would have to do is add up those flagged entries and the amount of the cuts would equal the amount of the total overall fee cut.
Your time expired about 5 minutes ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I wasn't even paying attention. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You'll be back for another 10 minutes. Thank you. Mr. Hallam, 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Jeff Hallam. I'm here representing the 7th Judicial Circuit on this matter, counsel. I'm going to start at a fundamental premise that the court has addressed. This is a writ of certiorari. The sole issue before the court is whether the circuit court jurisdiction was abused or the court acted in excess of its jurisdiction. This is a jurisdictional review. TAPI was an appeal, and the scope of a review of TAPI was an appellate review. It went to the correctness of the decision. Petitioner cannot get past this initial issue of jurisdiction.
So what are you
Oral
saying?
Argument.
Are you saying then that every time a lawyer disputes a fee, they've got to go through a direct appeal so that if their client wants to appeal and they want to appeal, there's got to be dual appeals?
A writ of certiorari as a matter of law, and this court has said, is the sole scope, unless expanded by statute, is whether there's jurisdiction. That's it. There are appellate remedies. TAPI was an appeal of the attorney's fees. This is not an appeal. This is a writ of certiorari.
What do you do if there's an acquittal?
Excuse me?
What do you do if there's an acquittal and you can't have an appeal, can you?
Your Honor, the way I read 1526A is that this is a final decision, not otherwise appealable, and it could go up.
What about
there
the
was
other?
An avenue to go up. Petitioner chose not to do that. Petitioner chose to file a writ of certiorari.
Other courts, though, have traditionally used this writ to review attorneys.
Some other courts have done that, Your Honor, but this court has never expanded the writ of certiorari unless it's been expanded by statute. So what this court would be doing is ignoring its past precedent and creating a judicial exception to the standard of review under writ of certiorari, but the legislature has not provided so.
So how else would Ms. Duffy have gotten this before the court?
Direct appeal, after the decision was rendered. After the decision, the circuit court issued an order affirming the case. There was a final?
There's not a file involving this case as far as attorneys.
There needed to be one. There was one that was created for the court, and that would be how it should proceed.
Was there one created before the court?
Yes.
What was the number of it?
They created as a miscellaneous file and it's with the court. That whole attorney fee petition, the review process, the letters were all prepared and submitted. So that's how it would need to be done, is that if you're going to challenge the fee petition under the guidelines, there would be a separate file open. And then the circuit court reviews, and it's a de novo review. This decision is not what Judge Kern did. This is a decision of what the circuit court did under the guidelines. Tappy talks about the presiding judge. If you apply Tappy, you look at what the circuit court did as a whole in their de novo review. But we don't get past the issue of writ of certiorari in this case because there's been conceded jurisdiction. Circuit courts, by statute, have the ability to determine what's reasonable and just compensation in accordance with the guidelines of the presiding judge. It's conceded that here the presiding judges did establish guidelines and that the circuit court operated under those guidelines, and they also operated under TAPI, which is the other quasi-jurisdictional issue on.
Using that theory, though, couldn't you also say that if you brought it on a writ, that the actual determination of this court is whether or not they followed those guidelines or went beyond the guidelines?
If it would be a
therefore, it's a jurisdictional issue. It's if they went beyond the guidelines.
If they violated the guidelines, the question is that jurisdictional or is that an irregularity in the proceeding? If it's an irregularity in the proceeding, then it's not reviewable under writ of certiorari. Whether the decision is correct or not is not reviewable under writ of certiorari. You're looking at jurisdiction. The fact that you may make a wrong decision does not deprive the court of jurisdiction. So
you're saying by the fact that discretion is involved in this case by itself virtually precludes review by certiorari, as long as they follow the rules.
Exactly, Your Honor. That is the initial position that I'm taking, and that's the initial position that was argued.
Okay, well, what if they don't follow the rules?
They don't follow.
In this case, it's alleged that they didn't follow the TAPI factors.
If they're not following the rules, then the matter's remanded back to follow the rules.
So in other words, if they said, well, we're paying you $50, that's it. We don't care what the guidelines say. We could review that on certiorari. But if they say, well, based on our collective 100 years on the bench, this case is worth X number of dollars and it's within the guidelines, then that precludes certiorari review.
That's how I read the court's precedent, yes.
Wouldn't in both cases they be dealing with the law, whether or not they abuse their discretion?
An abuse of discretion, Your Honor, does not go to excess of jurisdiction. I think abuse of discretion.
I know.
Is,
so are you? You're falling back or leaving a gap now in your jurisdiction argument?
No. If the rules have been followed and there's not an excess of jurisdiction, you don't get to the merits of the decision on the writ of certiorari. You don't get to the issue of whether there was an abuse of discretion. As long, any more than you would get to the issue of whether the decision was correct. This court in the past has said that if a court made a decision, even if it was contrary to the preponderance of the evidence, it's not reviewable under certiorari. Even though there may be errors in the proceeding, it's not reviewable.
Right.
So even if certiorari.
So even if they violated the rules and they paid at $50 an hour rather than at 60 or at half, at 50%, you still say there's no jurisdiction.
If they violated the rule, in this case, there's two rules. One would be the hourly fee. And that been conceded that was not violated. The next issue is the reasonableness of the compensation, and that was following the guidelines. And the question is were the guidelines followed? From a jurisdictional standpoint, were the errors such that it deprived the court of jurisdiction, or were they clearly in excess of their jurisdiction? And the position that, from my review of the record, Your Honor, is that answer is no.
All right, let's assume you lose on your first point. Do you agree with your opponent that there's no need for a remand, that this would be de novo, that we should just do it ourselves, determine what's reasonable, what's not reasonable, what's discretionary, and what's beyond discretion?
Your Honor,
what's an alternative argument for you?
It depends upon what the court determines, whether the court decides to make the decision or remand it back. I don't know how the court's going to decide the matter.
We don't either, but go ahead.
But if I could go back and to say, is there an abuse of discretion, and what is the court standard of review, I can answer that. Is that what petitioner did not argue or refer the court to were the Iowa cases that interpreted Hulse, which is a case that Tappy relies upon. And in those subsequent cases, the Iowa Supreme Court said that the trial court or the circuit court is not restricted to merely paying based upon the hours claimed.
Are you saying we should give the circuit court judges another opportunity to take a bite at the apple, say for the fourth time, if you accept your opponent's argument?
If this court says what is an error is the explanation, then yes, it would go back, because that would be a guideline violation. If the court is saying that there was an actual abuse of discretion and that the full fees were warranted, there is no reason to remand it back. I don't agree with that determination. I don't think the record supports that. But if the court determined to give petitioner the full fee, and that the court clearly abused its discretion in doing any cut, there is no reason to send it back, because then there's no explanation the circuit court could raise that would overturn the court's determination. Basically, then what this court has decided is that it was going to exercise the discretion.
How about in a situation where $1,000 in fees were allowed, $500 of fees were earmarked as some explanation was given, which may or may not suffice as to why it was being cut, and yet there's another $500 that was cut without any explanation. Remand or not remand?
In this case, Your Honor, there was an explanation for all the cuts. What Ms. Duffy has been requesting is an itemized, specific explanation for each and every cut. There were explanations for the cuts for each one of the cases. So if the court is requiring, as you've questioned Ms. Duffy on direct, of is the circuit court requiring to go through each line item and determine how much is done based on what's the record and justify that, and then have it all balance out so each one of those cuts end up on the bottom to equal the cut? That's one issue. The other question is can the circuit court, as an expert in determining the reasonable value of fees, and consistent with the courts that have decided the issue, that says, yes, the circuit court and the trial judges have the ability to make a decision as the case as a whole, with the benefit of hindsight, because that's the only way that you can determine the reasonableness of attorney's fees. That's what judges do.
But following up on that, wouldn't that, if the method of review by the court, the circuit court, is more of a flat fee or a flat amount per case, which appears to be part of the thing that they've done here, is that this is just too high, it should be less than this. Wouldn't that go along with your argument then, that would be beyond their authority then and outside the guidelines, because the guidelines allow reasonable attorney's fees?
No, Your Honor. If the fee is too high for the case, then what is being paid out is an unreasonable attorney fee.
The guidelines aren't per case. The guidelines aren't set up that you get so much per case, that you get a $5,000 for an aggravated assault, and, you know, it isn't a flat fee guideline at all. It's reasonable compensation for the hours. That's how it's set up, because it's a per hour guideline.
But
so if they would look at it and say, as a more of a flat fee, wouldn't they be without the guidelines? Wouldn't they be working without or outside the guidelines?
No, Your Honor, because to take your premise would mean is that you couldn't go beyond the hours charged. It'd put the circuit court in merely a bookkeeper and adding up the arithmetic. You have to look to see whether the activities are reasonably necessary. And so there is no right to recovery for every hour worked. There is no case that says that. Tappy doesn't say it. The Iowa cases that interpret Hulse don't say that. People v. Parks, there's not one case that says that you make a determination based on all the hours worked. No case says that. That removes the discretion that's inherent in Tappy and all of the factors. What you've now done is turn Tappy into a single factor, the hours worked. You have now removed all those other factors. The Iowa Supreme Court rejected that, said you don't just look at the hours worked. You look at the reasonable value of the case. What is this case worth?
But that isn't our standard in this state, is it?
Your Honor, Tappy was based upon cases in Iowa. The Iowa cases are interpreting what Tappy cited, and they're saying the factors in Tappy are not merely hourly.
Now, there's been some changes in the way we deal with attorney's fees since Tappy. These guidelines have been established since Tappy, and the per hourly fee has been set statewide.
But
you'd agree with that. So there have been some changes made since Tappy.
Tappy, though, talked about the hourly fee. There's two factors, separate and apart. One is the reasonableness of the per hour fee. The second part is whether the hours are reasonably necessary. Now, and
counsel, how do you justify the court striking line when the court goes through a line item? How do you justify it when the court doesn't allow even the time that the court that the attorney's in court?
Your Honor, if the court made a determination that the type of motion, the type of proceedings weren't reasonably necessary, the fact that you're in court is no different than I'm doing research or I'm doing an investigation. The question is the time spent reasonably necessary?
But this example involved a case where the defense was summoned, essentially, because the state had moved. It made a motion. So the defense counsel was required to appear and at that motion, and yet the cut is for less than the amount that counsel was in the courtroom.
Under those circumstances, then you would be deciding that no matter what occurred during that hearing, that the judge would have no discretion. The question is what occurred during the hearing, what issues are raised? If you look at the little hearing, a lot of it took place on questioning regarding investigative techniques that were irrelevant because Mrs. Little admitted everything. And the expert at the end of that hearing said, well, all these biases don't mean anything. They're moot because she admitted it. So what you had was a whole lot of hearing that the end result was their own expert said, no, none of this is relevant. So what you're saying then, under those circumstances, does the judge have a discretion looking at the benefit of hindsight? Was all the time spent during this hearing reasonably necessary? And Judge Kern felt no. Not to say that would be, how can you cut research then? How can you cut investigation? You can't cut anything then, because you can always say something was necessary.
The court has the control over the time. I mean, if the court thinks that time is being wasted, the court has rules to deal with that. Counsel can't leave the courtroom while the judge is sitting at the bench.
There's certain times, Your Honor, but it's also a matter of giving the person the right to for a defense. There's two issues. One is a right to present a defense. The second one is to fully compensate for that. There are two different issues. And the courts have said, though you're required to investigate and you're required to research and you're required to be zealot, the county is not obligated to pay for all of that any more than a party on a losing side in a 1983 action, any more than your client is required to pay for all that action. When you're looking at the reasonableness of the attorney's fees, you need to look at the whole picture. And that's when the courts that actually look at it, that's how they make the determination. You look at the whole picture, with the benefit of hindsight, with the independent judgment, and the court's expertise, and you make the determination of whether these fees are reasonable.
So what direction, though, does that give to the defense counsel that's appointed? How are they going to know how much work they should be spending on what? And what kind of guideline does that give the attorney that's representing the defendant? I mean, most of these probably have not been, these are not easy cases to defend as well, and you're asking somebody to take this case. Now, what direction do you give them then on what they ought to spend on what things?
That is the attorney's responsibility, Your Honor.
So they need to go into it knowing they're not going to get paid for part of their work.
They may not. They have to use their own independent judgment, just like I would in a private case. You know, how much time am I going to spend on it? And if I do excessive, then it's not reasonable. Otherwise, there's no reason for review. Circuit court might as well just sign off on them, because how can you ever go on an individual basis and say, as to that particular lawyer, how much time is needed? We all know that there's never enough time to do all the research you'd like to do. There's never enough time to do all the investigation you want to do. There's always legal theories that you can raise. The percentage of victory is very small, but you have to make those decisions of what is reasonably necessary to advance your client. And there's no record here of gross abuse on the part of the circuit court. This is not random cuts of everybody that goes in front. These are isolated circumstances. And the reason why the circuit court looked at Ms. Dovey's cases in these four is because it was beyond the ordinary of what the other lawyers are doing.
What about their statement, though, that they need to do this because of the budget?
I think that a budget is a factor. You're talking about tax funds. And what it is it's a responsibility of balancing. An indigent defendant has no responsibility to check how much time your lawyer's going to do, because they're not paying anything. There is no responsibility of a check. Absent the court, the lawyer has no check on how much time. I mean, if this is just going to be run the clock and how many ever hours you do, you get paid, there are no checks on what's reasonably necessary. You just pay.
But the constitutional right to counsel is not limited by the amount of money that the government may have available.
But the constitutional right to counsel does not require that the attorney gets paid any more than reasonable and just compensation. And reasonableness and just compensation may not be every minute that they presented and prepared a case. And there is no court that has equated the fees with the duty to represent. Our court Johnson versus City Commission of Aberdeen made a determination that the courts will not order anybody to represent an indigent without reasonable and just compensation. Our statutes provide for that. That does not change the requirement that I take in the oath as a lawyer to represent my client zealously. I know when I'm being involved in an indigent defendant case that that's part of my responsibility to society, that I'm not going to get fully compensated. This is not a full compensation issue. This is fulfilling the obligations of the state, but also you have the professional responsibilities of the attorney involved. And that means less than market rate compensation, and that means is that you should only be compensated based upon what is reasonably necessary. And that's what the circuit court did in this case. To do anything else, you turn the court into a mini trial, or what you've done is merely regulate the circuit court into adding up things with arithmetic. Neither one of those fulfilled the ultimate responsibility of the circuit court judge in their duties. I see that my time's gone.
One question. Under your writ of certiorari, your excessive jurisdiction argument, is it your position or the state's position that the appeal time has already run on all these underlying matters, and that therefore Ms. Duffy could not come back and appeal her attorney's fees in relation to those cases because the time is up?
The appeal time started running at the entry of the circuit court's order of affirmance. And that time has ended months ago, Your Honor.
Yeah, so the time's expired, she'd be out completely.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hallam. Ms. Duffy, you have 10 minutes.
I'd like to first point out an issue that was raised by Mr. Hallam, both in his brief and again here at oral argument today, that I think is completely misleading. He stated in his brief that Tappy is distinguishable from this case, and this goes to his jurisdictional argument, because Tappy was an appeal, not a writ of cert. The amicus brief that was filed in this manner pointed out Mr. Hallam's error and said that Tappy was indeed a writ of cert case, not an appeal. Despite the fact that his error was pointed out to him in the amicus brief, Mr. Hallam appears before this court and continues to assert that Tappy was an appeal rather than an application for writ of cert. I'd like to read to the court directly from the Tappy decision at page 894. On January 13, 1982, appellant filed an, quote, application for writ of certiorari, quote, with this court, seeking review of the order cutting his fees. Tappy was a writ of cert case. Furthermore, in determining what their standard of review will be on the application for writ of cert, the Tappy court states, we will not disturb the circuit court's determination on appeal absent a gross abuse of discretion. I acknowledge that the standard that I have to meet in order to obtain an order in my favor or a remand is to show that the district court abused their discretion grossly. I believe that they did that in this case by not paying me for time that I spent in court. I would like to revisit that issue briefly. I don't buy Mr. Hallam's argument that a court has discretion to disallow time that an attorney spends in court. Perhaps the case would be different if I was in court on an issue or a notice that I had raised, and the court determined in retrospect that that was frivolous. If I had noticed up a Daubert hearing and wasted 3 hours of the court's time, and the court looked back on that and said, you know what, I'm truncating this hearing, we're ending it now, this is going nowhere, and I'm not going to pay you for it. That's not the facts under this case. This hearing was necessitated by the state's notice. I had no choice but to be there. I had to be there to defend my client's rights. And it is a gross abuse of discretion under Judy versus White for a court not to pay me for the full time that I spend in court defending my client. I could not get up and walk out at the 2 hour mark if I was somehow prescient and could foretell that Judge Kern was not going to pay me for the last 40 minutes of the hearing. The gross abuse of discretion is also shown in the Wilson cases where my time was cut for the items I mentioned before, reading the indictment, reading the Supreme Court case. Those are clearly necessary to the defense of that client. Perhaps if the circuit court had reduced those time entries, I wouldn't be here today instead of entirely striking them. The other aspect of gross abuse of discretion that's present in this case is the complete lack of any explanation for large portions of these cuts. $1,000 alone from the little ANN. Tappy says it is the obligation of the circuit court to provide an explanation. SDCL 23A-40-8 and our standing order in our circuit provide that it's mandatory for the circuit court to explain the cuts. And a budgetary rationale for the cuts is not acceptable. This is a contractual relationship between myself and the county. And I believe that, yes, if I submitted a bill that included unnecessary time and wasting of time, that they would be entitled to cut that. But imagine if I were here with a private client who had retained me and who had not paid my bill because he said, you know, it just doesn't fit in my budget this year. I've spent too much money already on housing and clothing and that vacation we took this summer, and I just don't, it's just too much. I just don't have the money to pay you in full. So I'm cutting your bill 50% and you should be happy with that. This court would not countenance such a rationale from a private litigant, and it should not countenance such a rationale from a circuit court that is charged with enforcing the laws in our state. There is a check and balance on the amount of time that I submit on my bill. It is not strictly an accounting function. The circuit court still retains the power to review that bill and to strike entries that they think are not reasonably necessary or that I've spent too much time on, but the defendant also has an interest in reviewing that bill. In every single criminal case I've ever been appointed on in circuit court, at the end of the case, when my client is sentenced, the circuit court asks me, what are your attorney's fees to date? And I tell the circuit court what my attorney's fees are to date, and repayment of those attorney's fees to the county is made part and parcel of the judgment against my defendant. In fact, I recently had a case involving a juvenile that I represented for Judge Eckridge up in Sturgis, and she did not request a court-appointed attorney, but he was concerned for her, concerned about her mental disability, and so he appointed me to make sure that due process was served. At the end of that case, he asked me what my attorney's fees were and were going to add them on to the judgment, and I inquired about the propriety of doing that in a case where the defendant had not asked that I be appointed. And he indicated he was going to add it on to her judgment anyway, and I said that I would provide those services for free rather than to have my client tagged with attorney's fees that she had not requested. There is a check and balance on the billing practices of attorneys who represent criminal defendants. I will reiterate what I said in my initial argument, and that is this court has jurisdiction over the subject matter and the parties. This is an original action, and I believe you have all the information necessary for you to be able to make a decision in this case. And I am asking you to make a final decision and not to remand. Whether it's favorable or unfavorable, I would like to bring an end to these proceedings. To date, I have spent 36 hours pursuing this matter of this fee dispute, and I have spent $760 out of pocket. I would like to put an end to this. I would like a decision from the court on the merits of the appeal. Specifically, I would like you to award me $5,957.41 plus prejudgment interest from the date of Judge Kern's December 11th letter. I would just say that I made a deliberate decision in this matter to represent myself pro se in the event that the court had questions about how these matters were handled, and I would be more than willing to answer any questions that you may have in that regard.
Now, you asked for appellate attorney's fees as well, didn't you?
I did, Your Honor, and I can't cite you.
Are you agreeing to that for that?
I can't cite to the statute right now, but there's a statute that provides for unreasonable and vexatious litigation, and that's the statute that I would be relying on.
Who was vexatious on the judges?
I believe they were. I asked for an explanation of these cuts, and still today, as I stand here, a year after these bills were submitted, there are large parts of the bills that have never, the cuts that have never been explained to me.
Well, one other question on the procedure, just out of curiosity. When you had these meetings with the judges, was the county president allowed to be heard, or was
no.
It just you and the judges?
It was just the four judges and I.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Actually, my husband came along for moral support.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you. Court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.